Let's go to our music feature. And today we're talking about American singer and actress Doris Day, widely known as one of the best voices of her generation. Musicologist Dr. Gregory Camp from the University of Auckland is here to unpack why movie studios landed on the girl next door image for Doris Day and how her singing set her apart from the pack. Hello there.
Hello.
You've been on the show before talking about Disney and the music of Disney.
Yes, I have, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and so was that sort of part of your path to Doris?
Somewhat. The Disney thing brought me into the 50s because it's the 50s when Disney really took off. And then the 50s brought me into Doris Day and various other actors and actresses of the time.
You're currently writing a book called Scoring the Hollywood Actor in the 1950s. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a, not really a compendium, but a series of different chapters about various directors, composers, and actors, looking at how actors interact with music in the films of the 1950s.
How important was music to film in those days?
Hugely important. Throughout the whole history of the genre of any kind of film, it's been important. But in the 50s, you start to get a new kind of experimentation in the scores that are being written, as well as in the acting, with the growth of method acting, James Dean, Marlon Brando, people like that. And composers tried all sorts of different ways to match that style of acting with the music.
And so you have chapters on various different performers. Aside from Doris Day, what sort of names are we talking about?
James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, a few chapters on directors, so Alfred Hitchcock, looking across some of his films, Douglas Sirk, Vincent Minnelli.
When you think of James Dean and Marlon Brando, you don't immediately think of music, but how does the music sort of fit into their work?
Good question. So, for example, with James Dean, new style of young, angsty actor. So the composers and the music departments of the Warner Brothers studio thought, well, we've got to match this somehow. So he happened to have a piano teacher in New York who was named Leonard Rosenman, avant-garde composer. And James Dean went to the studio and said, I've got this guy who writes really neat music. Can we try him out on this film, East of Eden, that I'm making? The director, Ilya Kazan, said, sure, let's go for it. So we get what's one of the first atonal scores in the history of Hollywood. So instead of being your typical soaring love themes and, lots of harmonic resolution, cadences, things like that, you get something that's much more avant-garde in style, that matches the acting style pretty well.
And presumably pretty ahead of its time.
Yeah, very much.
Okay. And then there's Doris Day, and so plenty to talk about her. Where does she sort of fit into the scheme of things in the 1950s in particular?
Well, her music is definitely not atonal. Much more traditional, conventional musical type of music goes with what she's doing. It's one of the interesting things about the 50s. You get this strand of the avant-garde that exists alongside the more traditional style of film musical and film music. So it makes for really interesting juxtapositions.
And, of course, as always with the Tuesday music feature, we're going to play some music as we chat. So the first one we're going to play is Secret Love. And is this quite typical of her style?
Yeah, this was one of her big hits. It's from 1953's film Calamity Jane. And it's a typical ballad. She was really well known for singing ballads. And I think you'll hear why. If you don't know this song, it's very good.
Here it comes.
I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free. So I told a friendly star the way that dreamers often do, just how wonderful you are and why I'm I'm so in love with you. Now I shout it from the highest hill. And my secret love's no secret
RNZ National, Secret Love by Doris Day from the 1953 film Calamity Jane. And Gregory Camp is in for our Tuesday music feature, playing us some of the music of Doris Day and helping us to understand what made her so special. What was it about her voice?
The list goes on, and every time I listen to that in any of her recordings, I think of more things. What really struck me listening through to it just now was how well she uses the microphone. She knows how to get the breathy sound, but still have the tone quality, and also how to get the more belty type sound, the louder sound, with no break in between. She modulates her voice so well that you don't register that there's any kind of gear shift in there. It's just her crescendos and decrescendos, getting louder, getting softer, are so smooth.
She was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, not known as one of the showbiz capitals in the U.S. How did she get her start?
She started on the radio, worked for about 10 years, I think, as a radio singer, and got a fair amount of fame out of that.
Was there a car accident or something that played a pretty big part in her early life?
Yeah, I think so. It's a car accident, and that led her to want to become a singer, work more seriously on the singing. Get into voice lessons.
Okay, so carry on. So she got a bit of a break with Bob Hope, I think.
Yeah, a big radio star of the time who also worked in film. So getting involved with a big name like that was a good thing for her career.
Okay.
And then her film career came about when Julie Stein, one of the great composers of Hollywood and Broadway of the mid-20th century, happened to catch her act. She was doing a nightclub act at the time. And they needed a star for this movie called Romance on the High Seas. It was supposed to star Betty Hutton, but she was pregnant, so she couldn't do the part. So Julie Stein went to the director, Michael Curtiz, and to the producers and said, I've got this girl, maybe she'll work out. So they hired her, and there we go.
Hollywood dream, eh?
Yeah.
Have you seen that movie?
Yes, I have.
Tell us about it, Romance on the High Seas. She's not the star, but I think she's got fourth billing or something.
Well, she has fourth billing, but really she is the star of the film. She dominates the film. At the time, they probably wouldn't have given first billing to someone who'd never been in a movie before.
Right.
That's just not how the star system worked.
Uh-huh.
But she does play the lead, what ends up being the most important role, and most importantly, she does the most singing. all but two of the songs, and there are about six songs in the show, are sung by her, either the first time you hear them or in a reprise.
And you observe that they're quite a mix of genres, these songs.
They are. There's a ballad, there's a swing number, there's an up-tempo, like a novelty song. I think what the studio is doing here, the studio being Warner Brothers, is trying her out in various different guises to see what's going to stick, to see what audiences respond to, what they want to hear more of. Because then what we see in her subsequent films is they keep trying her out on a few different things, but eventually the ballad, softer kind of style is what sticks as she becomes the girl next door.
But she could have done any of them, do you think?
She could have. And in that film, it shows that she could have done any of them. But there is something naturally about her voice that lends itself to slower ballads because her tone quality is so gorgeous.
What is it that makes her a star? I mean, that's a question for the ages, isn't it? But when you see her, what is it that... I mean, she lights up on screen. She draws your eye, no doubt.
She does. It's partly her speaking voice as well as her singing voice. Her speaking timbre is similar to her singing timbre. It's just very bright and very light, easy to listen to, pleasant to listen to.
Mm-hmm. We've got a track from that movie. Tell us about Put 'Em in a Box, Tie 'Em in a Ribbon.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite songs from this film. It's not a well-known song at all, but it's by Julie Stein, as composer, and Sami Khan as the lyricist. And it's an example of a swing number, the kind of thing that she didn't sing very much of later in her career. But again, they're trying her out and seeing how she does. And she does very well with this number.
Here it is.
You can take the moon, gather up the stars and the robins that sing merrily. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. You can take the flowers down in Lover's Lane and that sentimental poetry. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. Not for me, all that stuff, the dreams that ruin your sleep. Not for me, had enough. Love is one thing you can keep. You can take the plans and the wedding bells and whoever sings, oh, promise me. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. 'Cause love and I, we don't agree. Kisses in the dark, all the promises made faithfully. Put them in the box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. And you won't go wrong if you take a song sung by Frankie Boy or Mr. C. Put them in the box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. Not for me, all that stuff. Not for me, had enough. You know what to do with good old T for two and the girl for you, the boy for me. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. 'Cause love and I, we don't agree.
It's Doris Day singing Put 'Em in a Box, Time with a Ribbon from the 1948 movie Romance in the High Seas. You have any trouble tracking these movies down as you were doing your research?
Sometimes. With Doris Day, it's not so much a problem because she worked mostly at Warner Brothers, and they, well, kind of a long story, but they were, their library, all of their films, were bought by Ted Turner and the Turner Corporation, and he was very keen on releasing these. So when we work with Warner Brothers and MGM and RKO, who were all in the same deal, those are a lot easier to find than films from some of the other studios.
Making a lot of people happy today. Philippa says she spent many weekends as a kid glued to her black and white TV watching Doris Day movies, her favourite Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Joan says, thanks for the memories, just loved her movies and her hits. She's a real girl next door. Ellie Harper, who we've mentioned on the show before, does a Doris Day show and actually got to meet her, went to Doris Day's house. And it's probably not well known, says Richard. The opening bars of Secret Love are in the opening of Me and Mrs. Jones from 1972. Have you heard that one?
No, I haven't.
Okay, we'll have to investigate that. Mm-hmm. Sinead O'Connor did a version of Secret Love, says Rowena.
Oh.
So Doris Day obviously has some success with Romance in the High Seas, and they ramp up production on the movies, hey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was making two or three movies every year. I think in 1951 she was in five.
Mm-hmm.
So they when they put a star under contract, they worked them as hard as they could. So most of the big stars of that time were making two or three at least films a year.
And in those days, being pigeonholed was seen as quite a good thing, right?
Yeah, because the audience knows what they're going to get. The studio knows that there are enough people out there who are interested in that who will buy the tickets and go see the movie.
So what was the image they were curating for her?
She becomes the ideal girl next door type. Sometimes she's also playing a young mother who's, like in her second movie, My Dream Is Yours, she plays a single mother whose husband was killed in the war, which allows her to have nice sentimental scenes with the kid, but also to fall in love with the leading man.
Yeah.
So that's convenient. Girl next door, domesticity is really the key. She's not like a Lauren Bacall type. She's not a Betty Davis type.
Mm.
She's going to get married. She's going to have kids.
Okay. Did that become a problem for her eventually?
It did, especially into the 60s when that idea of idealized American female domesticity is getting more and more questioned.
And she
represents all of that.
Yeah.
So she had a kind of a rough time in the 60s. She kept making movies in the 60s, but most of them weren't hugely successful. Her TV show was somewhat more successful then.
Mm.
And then she retired from acting in the 70s. There just wasn't really a place for what she meant at that time.
Interesting to contrast her with Marilyn Monroe, another blonde of the same sort of era.
Yeah. If you look at both of their early careers, they're very similar. Both of them got their start within the studios. So with Marilyn Monroe and with Doris Day, we can see how the studio is building their star personas through the films that they made. It took longer with Monroe because she started as a bit player, as an unknown, and worked her way up. It took about 10 films to do that, whereas Doris Day was already kind of a known quantity, although not in film.
Okay. I was just having a look at her obituary. She died last year, by the way. Just reading from the Herald, the running joke attributed to both Groucho Marx and ex-composer Oscar Levant was that they had known Doris Day, quote, before she was a virgin.
Yeah.
She sometimes referred to that, right? The the Miss Chastity Belt image.
Yeah.
And we're playing some music of Doris Day's as well, 39 films across a 20-year period. She never won an Oscar, apparently.
No, she didn't. She was nominated for Pillow Talk, but that was the only one.
We're going to play Everybody Loves a Lover from 1958. Let's get that one on now.
Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me anyhow. That's how I feel. Wow, I for nothing. Everybody loves me, yes they do. And I love everybody since I fell in love with you. Who's the most popular personality? I can't help thinking it's no one else but me. Gee, I feel just about 10 feet tall. Having a ball, guess you might call me Pollyanna. Everybody loves a lover.
It's a really good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where is, by the way, if you just tuned in, I'm speaking with musicologist Dr. Gregory Camp from the University of Auckland about the music and movies of Doris Day. Where did that one come from, by the way?
That I'm not sure. It's not from one of the movies. It must just have been a recording from one of her albums.
Okay. We were talking about how she always got married in the movies, was always marriage material. Do you know much about her personal life outside of the movies?
She had kind of a sad personal life. She was married a few times. Her third husband, who was named Martin Melcher, basically embezzled all of her money. And when he died, left her with lots of debt. So that's why she had to go into television, because apparently he'd made a deal for her without telling her that she had to make this TV show. And then she had to do it in order to pay off the debts.
Oh, boy. And that was the Doris Day show.
Yeah.
Which wasn't a big failure, though.
No, it lasted a few years.
And somebody wants to play. Ask if we're playing The Light of the Silvery Moon. I don't think we have that one on our playlist, but that was a favourite of... Who was it who called? We've had so many people message us. Jenna, definitely before my time, Doris Day, but I love that song. I used to watch it at her nana's house growing up. Thanks, Jenna. Nice to hear from you. 2101, if you'd like to text us. And Kay Sarah Sarah, would that be her most famous song?
I think so, which I think is kind of a shame because it's not a great song. Not my favourite anyway.
Because?
It's just corny.
Yeah, okay. Sentimental Journey, says someone on text.
That was her first big hit.
Was it?
Yeah, in the mid-40s on the radio.
Okay. We better play this one, though. And is this from the TV show?
Which one?
Kay Sarah Sarah.
That's from The Man Who Knew Too Much, her film with Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh.
1956.
Okay, let's take a bit of it.
When I was just a little girl, my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. When I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart what lies ahead. Will we have rainbows day after day? sweetheart said, que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see, que sera, sera, what will be, now I have children of my own, they ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be.
Sera, sera. RNZ National, Que Sera, Sera by Doris Day, apparently also the theme to the TV show. Someone's got in touch and reckons she won an Oscar for that one, but I've looked it up. I can't see it. I'm sorry. She did win. Oh, she was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame for that song. And she's won all sorts of awards, most of them sort of lifetime achievement awards, maybe recognising the fact that maybe she wasn't recognised at the time. And Gregory Campers, and talking about her music and movies and her life. So there was a strange link between Doris Day and the Manson murders.
Yeah, this is a weird story, and I didn't know about it until fairly recently. But her son, Terry Melcher, was a record producer in the 60s, worked with the Beach Boys and Paul Revere and the Raiders and some other bands in Hollywood at the time. And the house that those murders happened at, that Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate were living in at the time, he was the previous occupant. And Charles Manson wanted to be a singer and had come to Terry Melcher to try to get his, you know, to give him his demo. Terry Melcher wasn't interested. So, and you can see this in the recent movie, the Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Manson went round to the house when Polanski was living there and asked where Terry was. They said he'd moved away. And then no one really knows why he decided to go back to the house and kill everyone there. But that is the connection.
Incredible.
So through her son, through Charles Manson.
I'm really enjoying hearing a bit of Doris Day's voice. You're a musicologist, so we'll go deep with you on this one. You talk about the smoothness of what's called a passaggio break.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the voice has a number of different registers. When the voice goes from like a lower register into a higher register, it goes through what's called the passaggio. There are actually multiple passaggios. But what great singers can do, and Doris Day is one of these, is make you not notice that break,
mm-hmm.
so that the whole voice sounds like one voice. There's not a gear change, and this is what people learn in voice lessons, how to navigate that passaggio.
Uh-huh. Did she have much training?
Not a whole lot. She did take lessons, and you can tell when she sings that she had some training, because you can't sing like that and just kind of magically do it. But like most of the really famous singers of the time, they didn't have all that much training. A lot of it, they got the basic tools and then they kind of figured it out. Like Frank Sinatra didn't have formal training, for example.
Right. Tell me about this term, the belt register.
The belt register you heard in the Secret Love recording when it was very high and very loud. And Doris Day isn't known as a belter. She only rarely goes into that register, but when she does, it's pretty powerful. But that's another kind of break between the belt register and the more normal singing register that she navigates quite well.
Is that where the phrase belting it out comes from?
Yep.
Mm.
Yep.
We've got another song from Doris now. This is My Romance. Can you tell us a bit about this song?
This is what we call a standard, not a song that was written for her, but one that's been sung by hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of people over time. It's escaping me who actually wrote it. That's not very good, because it's a pretty famous song.
We'll find out during the...
So a lot of the music that she sung was written for her as part of the movies that she was in, or on the radio or on her TV show, but she was also very adept at singing these standards.
Richard Rodgers?
Oh, yeah. Rodgers and Hart.
Yeah. Okay, Rodgers and Hart. Also sung by Ella Fitzgerald, yeah. I know was a bit of an early influence on Doris Day.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the film Billy Rose's Jumbo, 1962.
My romance doesn't have to have a moon in the sky. My romance doesn't need a blue lagoon standing by. No month of May, no twinkling stars, no hide away, no song guitars. My romance doesn't need a castle rising in Spain, nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain. Wide awake, I can make my most fantastic dreams come true. My romance doesn't need
good one. My mm-hmm. Romance, performed by Doris Day for the movie Jumbo. I'm going to break the hearts of some of our listeners and tell you that Doris Day wasn't in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. You probably knew that, Gregory.
Yeah.
You're being too polite to correct us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Jane Powell.
Similar look?
Yeah, they were both blonde.
Okay. Oh, I'm very sorry for the listener who was having such fond reminiscences of watching Doris Day and Seven Brides and Seven Brothers, but that's what the memory does to you. Someone wants to know, what was the film with her and Frank Sinatra?
It's Young at Heart,
mm-hmm.
1954.
Worth a look?
Well, if you're either a Doris Day fan or a Frank Sinatra fan, yes. If you're not, then no, because it's not a great film.
Okay. Alison says she loved Doris's movies. She was a great actress, as evidenced by her role in Midnight Lace. Does that one mean anything to you?
Yeah, so that's a weird one. I'm surprised anyone knows it. 1960, sort of a film noir, basically a Gaslight type story.
Okay.
Her husband tries to drive her mad. And it's not a musical. She did make some films that weren't musicals, especially later in her career. Although usually there is room for a song, at least. I think in that one she maybe sings the song over the opening credits. But she did have fairly good dramatic acting chops. Midnight Lace is, I wouldn't call it one of my favorite films, but it's interesting. Set in England, although she's playing an American, but the rest of the cast is English. But it is an interesting one.
Somebody's praising her diction in songs. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. That's one another thing that really sets her apart. You can understand every word. Every consonant is there. It's all part of the line. Along with that goes her phrasing. Every phrase means something as an entity. She doesn't stop for no reason between words or anything like that.
When she died last May, one of her requests was to have no funeral or memorial service and no grave marker. Does that strike you as strange?
I didn't know that, actually. Not really, because I think throughout her career she was not really big on self-aggrandizement. Mm. She was very modest, didn't want to set herself up as the center of anything. She was sort of serving the music, serving the film.
When's your book due?
Next month.
Great. Good luck.
Thanks. It's nearly done.
I've got one last tune from Doris to finish, and Pillow Talk. How significant was this song?
Well, the film was really significant because this was the start of kind of a new phase in her career, playing more mature women. So in Pillow Talk, she is a single working lady working in interior decoration. She does get married by the end because she is Doris Day, but it does at least offer the idea that a woman could be independent. But she meets Rock Hudson and they get married.
All right. What's meant to be, eh?
Yeah. And this song is the title song of the movie. And I put it on the list because it's a good example of how she can sell even a song that's not that great.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gregory Camp.
Pillow talk, another night of hearing myself talk, 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 talk. Wonder how it would be to have someone to pillow talk with me. I wonder how, I wonder who. Pillow talk, another night of being alone with pillow talk. When it's all said and done, two heads together can be better than one. That's what they say, they always say. All I do is talk to my pillow, talk to my pillow, talk to my pillow. Boy, for me, I hope I'm right. I'd better be right. Oh, there must be a pillow talking boy for me.